Oh, did it say that on your side too?
Yep.
Oh, all right. I guess we're there. Welcome back to another episode of the Lookout Podcast. My guest is a very special guest, Larry Lufkin. We got cut off on the first one, so this is part two, and which is great because it gives us a little more time to catch up. And you were just telling me, just one example of how tenacious your father was, Francis Lufkin, who graduated in 1933 from high school, and he was supposed to graduate from 32, but they lost his records or something. Is that what you said, Larry?
Yeah, when he transferred over from his hometown in Auburn, Washington, to Winthrop, they lost his. That was the year he moved, and they lost his ninth grade records, which meant when he completed his senior year of class, they told him he couldn't graduate in 1932 because he'd never completed his freshman year. So that
Oh.
meant he had to go back to school for one more year, take the freshman classes all over. And then he graduated in 1933,
Which,
officially, that is.
yeah, which speaks, speaks, I don't know, miles, of his character because, back then, I mean, even until I think when my dad was in high school, it wasn't that normal to graduate. Like, people dropped out all the time still, up until I think that was the 70s, I think, when my dad was in high school, So it's like, back in the 30s, there probably wasn't that many people who finished that much education,
Yeah, he had a lot of stories about riding the school bus. He had to walk 2 miles from 8 Mile down to the bridge that crossed over the Chewak River, and they'd get on a bus and ride the bus into town. And he had stories to tell about just riding that bus every day, but
Jeez.
because there's no heat in the bus, and he
Oh.
said at the time all the girls the style was to wear their hair wet.
Oh,
Ooh, so when they'd get on the bus, when it was really cold, their hair would freeze.
that's what I was
And
thinking,
yeah. So
man.
stuff like that, yeah.
Everybody was tougher back then. Those gals going to school with frozen hair and probably battling pneumonia,
Exactly, yeah.
man.
So,
So you graduated high school, and then what happened to your dad after that?
well, Dad continued to stay at the Ranger Station for a few short years, staying with my uncle. I do know that he batched in Winthrop with several guys. One of them was killed on the Arizona in World War II.
Oh,
One of
no
his
way.
former, yeah, and Bump Vanderpool was the guy's name. How I remember that name, I don't know, but I don't know his first name. I just know that's what Dad called him, was Bump Vanderpool. But anyway, so Dad would work on ranches at times, but mostly was soon he was a little bit older. He was we worked for the Forest Service in the summertime, and then in the winter he would go over on the coast and log.
Oh.
And because I know you talked about logging up at Forks, Washington,
Oh.
and how they would ride the logging train up every morning and work all day, then ride it back to the base camp at night. And
Wow.
how he like they had the when they would fall a tree, those trees, of course, and over in that area were just monsters. And he got paid by the 40-foot log, is what he told me. And when they came upon a big cedar tree, they would he got paid 2 40s, he said, to drop a cedar that they could use for bedding for the fir trees. The cedars were considered garbage trees at the time,
Oh.
and so they would fall the fir trees on top of the cedar trees, and then drag them out and haul them down on a train.
Oh, gosh, a little bit of padding
Yeah,
so to snap that fir tree that hit.
exactly. Now the strange part about that is that decades later, loggers went in and were digging up all those old cedar trees and hauling them out and making lumber out of them,
Well, that makes
because.
sense, right? Because it's real rot resistant, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
And you probably know more about this than I do, Larry, but I want to say, like, right about when I rookied, back in 2013, they were talking about going up to like Ponderay Lake or, some of these deep lakes around here, maybe even Flathead. Like, it was a few lakes, and they were getting these old logs that were sunk to the bottom that were worth a ton of money. And I'm not sure if they like white bark pine or something, because, stuff that you can't log anymore, maybe. But I don't, did you hear anything about that?
I have not heard about that site. It doesn't surprise me a bit because back in the day, those trees were considered, like you said, junk wood. And
No.
so they would, wherever they fell, they just left them. But, you know, when they're down in that water like that, typically a lot of them are rot resistant. So
Yeah.
they could bring them up, knock the rot off of the outside and make lumber out of them. But
Oh, good.
like those cedar trees and those old fir trees, they were highly valued later on because they had such straight grain in them.
Oh.
They're all knot free and straight grain.
Yeah.
And so that's why they became, you know, really, really valuable.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah,
Yeah.
down in Oregon, there were trees down there that they were cutting and sinking in the bay so that the bugs couldn't get to them. And then when they wanted them, they'd raise them up and take them into the mill.
Oh wow! So like,
So.
yeah, preserving them. Yeah, maybe they're doing something like that around here because they used to use the rivers, right? Float everything down, at least around here, float everything down to the mill, and
Yes.
you know, maybe when the mill shut down or what, I don't. Maybe someone just sunk on the way, or maybe they were just preserving them. Like, I
Right.
wish I knew more about it, but it is a cool
Yeah.
story.
But then in the latter part of the 30s, I do know that Dad worked more for the Forest Service because he had a lot of stories telling about he'd take mule trains back up in there with poles to build phone lines and building trails and all that kind of stuff. He actually, I worked on a couple of lookouts a couple of times that I do know of. I don't think he was there all summer, but he was up there. And matter of fact, we were driving up the Chewock one time, and we came to this creek called Junior Creek, and which is up by Leroy Creek, if anybody ever goes up that way. But anyway, he told me, he says, I'm the one who named that Junior Creek.
Oh.
And I said, you were? I said, how'd that happen? He said, well, a whole bunch of them had been up on a horseback ride up building trails or doing something up in the woods. And as they came out, one of the guys mentioned, he says, you know, that creek there has no name. And Dad says, well, he says, we're going to name it after Junior. There was one of the guys on the crew, the lead guy was, I forget the guy's name, but his nickname was Junior. And Dad says, well, we'll just name it Junior Creek. And that's how it got its name.
Oh, geez.
The creek is actually dry most of the year. You know, it was a very small one.
Oh,
So
gotcha. Man.
there's little things like that. But and then in 39, that's when one of the jobs he'd had was climbing trees and stuff. So when the 39 experiment came along, that's one of the reasons that he got selected, is he could climb trees.
Oh.
And so that was really why he was brought in. And he would go up to Parachute Meadows, which is up above Winthrop there, up to Chewock, going over towards actually to the Okanagan side.
Oh.
If you take that road up Boulder Creek, you actually can take it clear up over the top of the mountain and come down into Tenasket.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I never
Yeah.
knew.
Yeah. I've never been over there, but I do know that's where the road goes. But anyway, I actually have a picture of him climbing where he's climbed up a tree. You can see the jumper above him, and it was a dead tree, and he'd guide the tree off, and he told me he'd climb up there, and he'd get them on their back or on his back, and he'd let, you know, raise them up, and then they'd let them down to the ground. And that was before they had letdowns set up.
Oh, so he'd just get up there, get some pressure off his riser so the guy could release him and have your dad as safety, and then he would rappel off your dad then kind of, or how?
I'm sure they must have used another rope, you know, to, you know, the guy would probably just shinny down the rope. It wasn't like they were 200 feet in the air. They were only maybe 30 or 40 feet in the air.
Oh,
The
gotcha.
trees up there just aren't that big. You know,
Oh.
they're high enough that you can't just jump out of your jump gear and hit the ground. And but anyway, now let me give you a little side story I just got yesterday from Bill
Really?
Moody. Yeah, from Bill Moody.
Yes.
Bill Moody forwarded an email to me from a lady who worked for White Boot Company in Spokane. You know who I'm talking about, right?
I think.
White Boot Company was for years and years the favorite of smoke jumpers for boots, for jumping boots.
Oh, yeah.
And the lady mentioned in her email that the very first pair of smoke jumper white boots was owned by my dad. And so I just sent her an email with a picture of him before he made that first jump in 1939. And I told her, I says, I've got my dad's last pair of white boots that he wore as a smoke jumper. They're probably purchased around 1970 or so, because they were in pretty good shape. But it's kind of strange how things go around in circles.
That is, very cool. Because, I think we had talked about that a little bit, but I think it was after we stopped recording. Because, man, that's wild. So, like, White was making boots, but they're probably, I don't know how long White's been around. I guess it might have been around for a while, I guess. But
well, since 39 at least. I was going to look them up on the internet, and I don't remember the date that they were established, but it was back in the 30s.
Yeah, and so your dad's first pair of boots, were they Dub smoke jumpers yet, or?
Well, they were the very first pair of smoke jumper boots that White sold.
Oh.
So, and I told the lady, I said, well, you would know more than that. I says, I wasn't born until 44. I says, I don't mean you're old. I says, you just have the records. So,
Yeah, totally. Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
And it just so happened she was talking to Bill Moody about it, huh?
Yeah, I don't know what their conversation was all about, but when he responded to her, he copied me on the email. So that's how I knew who he was dealing with over at White Boot Company.
Oh, gotcha. Was she interested in your dad's boots? Did she like want to check them out or anything?
Oh, I told her, I says, I'm supposed to have a phone conference with them here later on. Oh. And as far as I'm concerned, they can have them as demonstrators.
Yeah.
From far way back when.
Yeah, and talk about like proof of toughness too, right? You know, like to see an old pair of boots like that, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, back in my day, I got my very first pair of whites in 1963, just before I went to Cave Junction to rookie.
Oh, yeah.
And matter of fact, I don't know if you ever knew John Gordon and Ash Court. They were my classmates at Winthrop High School, and they both jumped at NCSB.
Oh, really?
Yeah, from my dad.
Oh.
And we all had all gone. Chase's was a merchandise store in Twist, and we'd go down to Chase's, and they would draw a picture of your foot on a piece of paper and send that off to White's, and White's would make a boot to fit your foot.
Oh, wow.
And I remember my very first pair of boots was around $40. You know,
no way. They put a zero on it now, right?
Yeah, I think it's yes, I'm sure. Yeah.
So did it fit like a glove then, like when you got it back?
Yeah, they fit perfectly. And the thing about them is, after 2 or 3 years of jumping, I could send them back and have them rebuilt.
Yeah.
And I had those rebuilt a couple of times, and I had them up until a few years ago, but they were all wore out, and then I'd stuck them in a shed, and when I went out to look at them, they're just covered in mold and about ready to fall apart. So I threw them away, but I still have my dad's last pair.
Man, that's incredible. Makes me want to go get a pair of white smoke jumpers, because I've never owned a pair of smoke jumpers, because I don't really know the history behind it. And when I was jumping, I think I was telling you, the logger boot or the hiking boot, fire boot, was starting to be more popular. You know, you, like the brands like Loa and La Sportiva and Scarpa, and those guys were coming out with.
Well, my recollection is that they came to the conclusion that having the high heel was great for walking and up and down hills, but it wasn't the best for your ankles, carrying heavy loads and stuff. And I know personally, I sprained my ankle a number of times on packouts, and I'd have to take my boot off and wind my ankle up tight in a bandage, and then put my boot back on and tighten it up as tight as I could get, and then limp on out, you know.
Jeez, yeah, just like a splint pretty much, huh?
Exactly, yeah. And just normal around working and stuff like that, and walking on the fire line, they were great.
Yeah. Because
you could dig that big heel into the ground, and you wouldn't slide.
Yeah, so nice. Like you said, on the side hills, and that's one thing I really miss. But, you know, growing up, I grew up in Whitehall, and my brother's rodeoing, and we had horses. I mean, my folks still have horses. So I was wearing a lot of cowboy boots, and I could feel it kind of my hips, like starting to get a little bit pushed forward. And then like my lower back was starting to get strained. So that's why I shied away from the big heel. But like you said, though, you can't beat it for the hillside, you know, or up in the mountains.
Right. Yeah. And I remember Jim Allen telling me that he when he was working for Dad in the late 40s, early 50s up in Winthrop, before he moved to Cave Junction, he told me that my dad was like a coyote up in the mountains. He said he could go up and down mountains just like a coyote. He said nobody could keep up with him.
Yeah, I bet. That's what, well, that's why I was wondering, you know, like getting the Smoke Trapper trials and stuff too. Like I was like, man, he must have had a reputation to be able to, you know, get in the experiment and then, you know, help get it to be you know, what it is today. A big
Yeah,
pro.
he was just one of those guys that had a look about him that everybody respected. And to the day he died, he was that way. And he, matter of fact, I was reading on Facebook, Gene Jessup, who was a former jumper at Winthrop, and was talking about the old man had a look, and all he had to do is look at you, and you knew whether you were in trouble or not. And Gene has a book out about all those experiences.
Oh, you'll have to check it out. And I don't think we recorded this one last time either, but you were telling me that he never fired anybody, but I can't remember exactly what you're saying.
Well, what I don't know if he did or he didn't.
Yeah.
What Jim Allen told me one day, we were chit chatting. I can't remember, over coffee or something, and after long after we'd both quit jumping. But anyway, and he leaned over. He says, "Yeah," he says, "the one fault your old man had," he says, "he would never fire anybody." And that was one thing that always bugged Jim, because there was a couple of guys that he would have liked to have gotten rid of.
Yeah.
I do know of one guy, and I'm not going to name names. I do know of one guy that my dad finally had enough of, and he worked out a deal with the forest supervisor and the forest supervisor and the regional office to give the guy an early retirement,
Oh.
and the guy left and went into private business. But that was the only time, and it wasn't like dad didn't like the guy. He was a good friend. He just was a lousy spotter, and a lousy boss.
I was gonna say, I think we've all worked with those like in any industry, but especially in the Forest Service. You know, you've been in this game long enough, and you've probably seen this, Larry. Like I've described it as like operationally, and I've had it the opposite, right? Where like operationally, I've had a guy who's like or gal who's really sound, but then like didn't really want to hang out with him afterwards, or it's worse when it's vice versa, where it's like it's your buddy outside of work, but during work you're like, man, just a dud when it comes to work, but outside, like, you know, heart of gold and a great human, but you're just like, man, it. When it comes to like, you know, putting out the effort, it sometimes just isn't there, you know?
That's exactly right. And there's a couple of guys to this day that they kind of grate on me. I mean, I'll talk to them and I'm nice, cordial, and that sort of thing, but I don't want to be friends with them because they frankly did me wrong back then, and I don't forget stuff like that.
Well, and that's one thing my dad told me when I was really young, and he put it in different words, but it's like you are who you hang out with, so like be wise who you choose your friends to be. Yeah, you should be nice to everybody, but like for your core group, you know, you don't want, you know, a bunch of people who are just, you know, like how the geese said slackers, you know, or people who aren't really getting after life. And that was very true. You know, I had a lot of friends that kind of fell off along my life path because they settled or, you know, just weren't really motivated. And I like being around more motivated folks. And that's why smoke jumping, I think, was attractive to me and a lot of folks is like, you're going with what is should be the elite of the, you know, elite of the elite wildland firefighters, you know.
Exactly. If you hang out with the tramps, you're going to be a tramp sooner or later. You just absorb that attitude. And I can tell you, I to this day, I have friendships with my high school buddies, and we all did great in later life. I mean, we're different avenues of the same thing, but we all went ahead, and a couple of them, John, for example, he was like in the he didn't even know what an indoor toilet was until he went to school
Wow.
at Winthrop. And he told me that one time. And if a guy ever had an opportunity to go bad, he was it. And the guy ended up, with a master's degree. I think it was a master's or maybe a doctorate. Became the school superintendent at Wenatchee and a couple of other places. I mean, the guy made something out of himself.
Yeah, it's just,
So.
and you can see it too. Like there's, you know, everyone thinks it's kind of a secret, but it's just like that tenacity that you're talking about your dad having. And I think we all kind of have a bit of it. I think anyone who's in the wildland firefighting world, but especially smoke jumpers, you know, like, cause I mean, no one's giving you, the opportunity to jump, right? You have to earn even to get into rookie training, and they have to earn to make it through rookie training, you know? And they're looking, Someone always says like they're looking to help you. They want to see you make it. But I think in the beginning, it feels like everyone's looking to wash it because like they want to, they want something they can build, right? Like I was told that too. Like in your first week, what's really hard because they don't. If you got any kind of quit in you, they want to know it early before they put too much time into you. And that made sense to me,
It does. Absolutely, it does. I will say this. I will th that the selection process now is 100% different than it was when I was hired back in 63. For example, in Cave Junction, when you applied to be a jumper at Siskiyou Smoke Jumper Base for Jim Allen, you had to fill out the normal form, but you had to attach a picture to it. And Jim loved to hire athletes. And so we had guys like Charlie Mosley, who was hired in 62. In 63, he was training for the decathlon in the Olympics. That's how good the guy was. As his little brother, Billy, jumped in my class, and Billy was a tight end for Paul Bear Bryant at Alabama. And the next year, one of their friends, Johnny Kirkley, came in, and he was like the fourth fastest 100-yard dash man in the SEC for Alabama. So
Holy.
those are the kinds of guys that Jim loved to hire. Now he didn't they weren't all that way. Some of them were like me, or just guys that were legacy, I guess is a way to put it. And but even us, he didn't put up with crap. He insisted that we were going to do it right or not do it at all.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, 'cause and for folks who don't really understand it, it also is a safety issue, right? Like if you're not doing it right, then you're a danger to yourself or somebody else. So there's no free pass when it comes to smoke jumping, because otherwise you end up dead or
Right.
somebody else does.
Well, let's face it. If they drop you out in the middle of nowhere, and you have to, number one, hit the ground safely, and then fight the fire safely and put it out, and then pack up all your gear and walk all the way out. It's not an easy job to do.
No, yeah, because I mean, like average, the 110-pound pack test is there for a reason, because the average, pack out you're doing is 100 pounds or plus,
I
and
know
then.
our final test in Cave Junction was a tree jump down in a little town called Kirby. And then once you landed and got on the ground, then you had to pack up all your gear, and it was a 7-mile walk back to the base. And that was our final test. You can't make that, you're done.
That's gonna be rough, because for folks who don't know, it's like you're getting this cumulative fatigue, and like little injuries throughout rookie training typically. I mean, nothing usually too severe, but you're getting beat up, because your muscles are getting broke down, because you're doing really difficult things every day nonstop, So at the end, to have that kind of push, that takes a lot.
The year I rookied, one of our trainers was a guy named Jerry Schmidt, and Jerry was a miler at Colorado State, and he ran a 409 mile in Denver. That tells you anything.
Yeah, high
And
elevation and
he,
fast.
exactly. Well, he'd take us out, and I mean to tell you, he would. We'd come back with our tongues hanging out to the ground. We were so tired. And he was just prancing around just like nothing was bothering him.
Yeah, just
And
light as a feather, those long
it
distance guys.
yep.
Like,
So, yeah.
yeah, because probably I'm probably like you, Larry, where it's like, I'm kind of hammering as I run, my feet are hitting pretty hard, and guys like that, though, they could weigh about the same as me, but they're just so used to running. It's like really light, just like kind of quick, like not really quick, but just like less pressure, it seems like, per step compared to me. Did you,
I know.
oh, go
Go
ahead.
ahead.
No,
No,
go
go
ahead.
ahead.
I was going to
No,
go on you.
I was going to say when I was in airborne training in 68 back at Fort Benning, one of the things we had to do is we had to run the like these this course. It was like the first week it was 1 mile, and the second week was 2 miles, and third week it was like 3 miles, something like that. Well, on the second week, some Yahoo, when you fell out, they would come up and take your number because you had a number on your helmet. They would take your number and report you, and then you could get kicked out of the training.
Oh, no.
Well, no, you didn't want to get kicked out because they made you wear a yellow helmet around and pick up cigarette butts for 2 or 3 days. But
Yeah.
anyway, somebody gave them my number, and so they called me in, and I got a big argument with the sergeant, and he says, "You dropped out." And I said, "No, I didn't." We went back and forth, and I finally said, "Look, let's go out right now. I'll run the course with you, and we'll find out, because I've never walked, dropped out of a run in my life.
Yeah.
And this officer was standing. He says, "Get the hell out of here." They knew they had somebody else's number.
Yeah. Oh man, but that's that tenacity you're talking about earlier that, it takes to get through that 101st Airborne and smoke chasing, and it's kind of hard to describe it. Mine wasn't quite as a big deal as yours, being, in the 101st, but like when I was interviewing for rookie training, they tell you the numbers, right? And they're like, in Missoula, they were telling me what folks before me who were interviewing had been putting up, and I don't know, because I didn't have the hot shot experience or something. They were like, we got guys doing, 20 over 20 pull-ups. They're doing, 100 push-ups. They're running a mile and a half in 9 minutes right now. It's not even, we're not even close to rookie training. And I was in cowboy boots and in a pearl snap, and I was like, I'll do all that right now. And I was serious. I was gonna go run a mile and a half in my cowboy boots in 9 minutes because I was that determined, I couldn't do it now. I couldn't do it now in running shoes, I don't think. But then I was in great shape, and I was willing to prove it, But
Well, I played a couple of games of racquetball this morning, and I can hardly walk now, but my knees are talking to me. So,
yeah, that's what we all have that in common, I think, And a few of my friends, they came into rookie training with bad knees from hot shotting and carrying all that, the saw and all the saw gear. So they were already up against it. So I was gonna ask you, did you ever get a chance to jump your dad's red suit, or probably not since you didn't go to NCSB, right?
No, the only time I was aware that that suit got jumped after the initial train, the initial experiments, was when Bill Moody wore that suit when the NSA filmed the trimotor jumps down in McMinnville, Oregon,
Oh, I was wondering.
and I'm positive that Bill wore that suit at
Yeah,
that time.
he sent me the photos, and I with the tri-motor and everything, and I didn't, and we didn't go into it in when I interviewed him on the podcast. So that makes sense. Very cool, though. What a cool tradition! The red suit and then a tri-motor. Oh, doesn't get much better than that.
I was actually trying to get just a ride in the tri-motor, but they I don't know, they ran out of money or time or something, because there were two or three of us that just wanted to go for a ride, and they said, "Sorry, we just can't do it, anymore." So,
Dang.
but yeah.
Definitely on my to-do list. I don't think it'll ever happen because I've never even seen one, but I would love to, bucket list is a tri-motor,
Yeah, there aren't very many of those around anymore, frankly.
That's what I heard. And then there's that, I don't know if you ever heard, but there's that one that crashed in the Bob Marshall Wilderness that was used for smoke jumping. I think it was a Johnson Flying Companies.
Yeah, back in the 50s or early 60s, I think. I can't remember exactly when.
Oh, gotcha. Yes. Yeah. I don't really know. I just knew it was back there, but that makes sense. And remember, they couldn't get it out, so they just kind of left it. And it sounds like they took a few pieces out. And now I think there's just like a tiny bit of it left, and they're trying to get it back to the flying museum where your dad's jumpsuit is, which would be kind of cool.
Yeah, I do remember that incident. I just can't remember exactly when it was, but it's a long time. Yeah, there was a DC-3 went in too, and
Oh.
got down in a canyon. I can't remember exactly where it went in, but the pilot, two pilots were killed, and the cargo dropper in the back and his dog both survived, and they walked out. That's
Oh.
how they knew where the wreck was,
Dang.
So
Yeah, I remember after I heard about the Ford Tri-Motor, I heard the rumor there was a DC-3, a jump one they're using for jumping in a lake somewhere, and that's as far as I got with it. I never heard exactly what happened, and that was when I was jumping on Missoula. I heard that rumor.
yeah, I don't know where either one of those planes are. I just know that it happened out of the, over in that Idaho, Montana area.
Oh.
And Moose Creek sounds like the name of the creek or the base, but I just don't know. Don't quote me on that one.
Yeah, I wonder. Yeah, it probably was Moose Creek, because I think there's a photo of that DC-3 flying, looking normal shape at Missoula Jump Base in the ready room area. And I think it does say something about crashing near Moose Creek, and
Yeah.
because I know they're going in and out of there quite a bit.
Well, the Forest Service used to have a lot of those backcountry runways, like in out of Winthrop. There was a runway there up in the Pasadena called it was Pasadena Airport, and they maintained that airport for decades, And finally, they when it became a wilderness area in a national park, I don't think it's been maintained since then.
Yeah, gosh, this is the first time I'm hearing about it, Larry. That sounds awesome. I love it
Yeah.
because that's like the, as you know, out of NCSB, that's where you want to jump, like everyone's trying to get that Poseidon jump,
All right. And I think I only made one jump up in that country. I jumped all around it, but never only the one in it.
Yeah, I'm saying like I jumped all around, but I never got in it. I jumped somewhere north of Omak country, and it was like around the border of Canada because I was getting weird service with my phone, and that was with Darren Belsby, so it was kind of cool. And it was my last job at NCSB, so a two-manner with Darren, so it was a great way to end it.
Yeah, in the summer of 70, I jumped in the Poseidon. They had a monster fire going there, and then they got a spot fire, and that spot fire, they dropped like 32 of us on it to fight that fire, and it was right on the Canadian border, literally straddled the Canadian border.
Oh,
I've
really?
often wished that I'd had a camera along and taken my picture next to Monument 86, because there it was right in the middle of our camp.
Really?
Yeah, a place called Peavey Creek. Why I remember that, I do not know.
Larry, you got a heck of a memory, man. That's awesome. Yeah. Well, cool experiences, and I was gonna keep rambling on a little longer, but family's getting ready to eat dinner with or getting
Okay.
up dinner right now, so.
That's right. 6:30 your time.
Yeah, so
Yeah.
that's about right.
So.
That's about what I was timing for. So, well, thanks, Larry. We'll do it again sometime. Hopefully, I can. So, I'd like to go out to your country and just take the family on vacation. So maybe I'll drag the Airstream along and we can do one in person.
Yeah, they'll love the coast. Out on the coast, there's some like the whole rainforest. It's got these monster trees in it that are like 20 feet in diameter. If they've
Really?
never seen trees that big, take them there.
No, yeah, they haven't. I mean, we got some of those big cedars, but nothing like that. Holy cow.
And there's a Kalaaloc Lodge. This is right on the water. Ocean Shores has got a lot of places to stay. And if you get the urge, you can actually go fishing out of Westport or one of those places like that.
I'd love to. If it's recent, the kids would be a little too young for that, but down the road, it'd be a cool place to go.
I used to get seasick, so I about every 10 years my dad would call me up and say, "Let's go fishing." I'd say, "Okay," and I'd spend the whole time crawling around on my hands and knees throwing up baiting lines, and he'd be over there just a fishing away.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he'd catch them for both of us.
Yeah, at least you had that going. Did you? Well, yeah, last question, I guess. Did you ever get airsick then, or?
I never did. That was the strange part. I did never get airsick. I saw guys get airsick, and it made me kind of wee queasy, but I never got airsick. But out on the ocean with that up and down wave motion just killed me.
Dang.
And so yeah.
Yeah, the human body is a strange thing because, yeah, like, I've known some pretty tough guys who were like one of my friends, McClay Schulte. He said he's fine. All of a sudden, one day, it was just, he didn't feel too good before they even got in the air, and it was really, really hot. And he said finally he popped. And then ever since then, he would always get airsick. And he said, so he's like, if you feel the urge, fight that thing, is what he'd always tell everybody.
My very last fire, I was told you that it was how bumpy the ride was, and up and down and back and forth. And my jump partner Lou Weyers got sick, and he and I were standing in the back right by the door, and our boss D Dutton was on the floor of the DC-3, spotting. And Louis threw up all over Dee's back. So, and how Louis hit the ground, I do not know, because his glasses were just covered with that stuff. He wore
Really?
big thick glasses. Yeah, but
Oh,
he made it down.
oh yeah, he was ready to hit the ground. He probably didn't care where at that point, probably, huh?
Exactly.
The poor spotter had to wear it the whole time.
Exactly.
Oh, it makes for a tough fight.
But anyway, well, okay, we'll go ahead and work out, the conversation on the phone, or if you happen to be this way, let me know.
Yeah, we'll do, Larry. And if you if something comes up, like it sounds like you're constantly getting some cool information. So if something comes up and you're like, hey, I'd like to just come on, even just for like a quick one, like you're got like 20 minutes or 30 minutes and just want to come share some cool information,
Okay.
please call me anytime.
Okay. If I run into something, like this thing with the white boots, I can just forward it to you for your information,
Email me or call me or text me, anything. Yeah, I really appreciate it, Larry. Thank you so much.
Sounds good then.
Appreciate your time, Larry. Thank you.
Talk to you later then.
Talk to you later. Bye. I don't really know. Oh, there we go.